Welcome to Driven Radio Show, your home for car talk covering the latest news to the greatest views on the biggest names in performance, sports, and just plain cool driving machines. Let's rev up the conversation. Time for Driven Radio Show.
Hey, all you gearheads and car fiends, welcome to Driven Radio Show, your weekly automotive happy hour. I am Brett Hatfield, here with my co-host and engineer extraordinaire, Mr. Mark Groves.
That's me.
And we are coming to you from Driven Radio Studios, where it's warm, at least for the moment.
Yeah, just wait, Sybil. It's about to change.
Well, you know, weather in Kansas, man. Hang out 24 hours, you'll get something different. real quick, update on your fantabulous 64 Dodge Custom 880.
Well, she's still getting a lot of medical love. The engine, the compression's fine.
Okay. Okay, that's good.
And Daryl's got the carburetor, took out the choke. So that it could at least get fuel going in and not too much fuel going in.
He didn't convince you to stick a Holley on that thing?
No, I talked to him about it. I actually mentioned it. He's like, well, no. He had some things to say about refurbs and some of the other stuff that's come out. So he's working with the original carb and has got it, you know, functioning. Mm-hmm. The problem was, or is, that he went in, he was getting like four cylinders.
Oh,
he was
no.
running on four. And that's why he did a compression test. And all eight cylinders are banging great.
Distributor plugs,
but the plugs were just a mess.
Oh,
a gummy mess, which indicates there might be also a fuel system. What he's hoping is that by putting in new plugs and the fact that the carb is running better now, maybe it will stop fouling the plugs.
Oh, okay, good.
And it will at least run decently, and then we can look in the future about
so
dropping
it ran decently
the tank.
Long enough for you to test drive it.
For me to test drive the son of a bitch,
and then everything went to pot.
Bless their pee-pick and heart. The people who previously owned it, I don't blame them at all. It's just one of those things.
You got and, fooled.
Luckily though, I kind of expected it.
Okay,
in my price range.
Yeah.
You know,
has he given you any kind of a timetable? You know when you're going to have your stuff?
No, not yet. And I haven't forced it on him because, you know, he's such a nice guy. And he was nice enough to take it with the stacks of cars that he already has in there.
Most of that crap's probably his.
I get the occasional walking verbal tour of, oh, well, that car, bar to dar, and I'll ask about one, the 59 yeah. Rambler that's in the back.
Yeah,
or the,
he's
what,
had 90, that forever.
95, 93, 95 Tempo that's up on one of the racks.
That Tempo is his?
It's, yeah.
Oh, crap.
Yeah. So okay. He's got quite a diversified collection.
And the motorcycles. And,
yeah.
And.
Yeah, that big boat back there.
That's
pretty.
It's stupid.
I wonder if all the cars that are parked in front of the place too, all his?
Yeah, he's got all that stuff for sale.
Oh, dear God.
If you're ever looking for bargain transportation, you got to go talk to Daryl.
If you can pry it out of his hands.
Yeah, that's Awesome Book Automotive, folks. 913-831-3613. I'm doing that just because I threatened to do it to him.
Good, good.
He hadn't been able to get any help, so he's completely overstressed and overworked. So I promised him I would continue advertising his place for him just to stick
it to him. Take him more.
You know, part of the reason he's not able to get to your car is because I keep sending him my crap.
You know, and when you were telling me a little bit about that before the show, I have to tell you this joke before you explain it.
Oh, no.
Because he had a joke for me because I called him and said, hey, we're recording the podcast tonight. And, you know, what are you, how's the Dodge looking? Got to give an update. He's like, well, besides it catching on fire, it's all right.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you're funny. And he's like, oh, well, maybe that was Brett's car.
Yeah.
And I'm like, very funny. I'll pass that on to him. And he's like, yeah, you probably don't want to. And I'm like,
already aware. So I try to keep fire extinguishers and the Corvettes and our old stuff.
Oh, because, God, I hate even how this sounds.
Because when old Corvettes catch fires, man, they burn up like old Christmas trees. It's just gone.
It's all that glue, that model glue.
It might have something to do with the fiberglass.
Might.
Anyway, the fire extinguisher that I had in the 65, I didn't really have strapped down to anything, and it kept rolling around. And, you know, they've got a safety pin on them and a little plastic safety strap you have to tear off before you get before you can use the fire extinguisher. That strap came loose and the pin came out and the thing rolled over and it did just a little quarter second micro shot of extinguisher powder in the back.
It's like when your great grandfather coughs.
Yeah. And I was like, God damn it. And so until I got that figured out, I just took it out and I set it on the floor of my garage, driving the Corvette Sunday morning and go to leave someplace down off 135th. Started the car, it was a little tough to start. It's like, yeah, I haven't had it on a charger in a while. Probably ought to put it on charger when I get home. And it made it about a block. And I was turning to get onto 135th Street and it died, and smoke immediately starts pouring out from under the hood.
No, 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 not this. Oh my God, the 65 convertible.
Yeah, my Corvette. My blue Stingray. And apparently something went south with the alternator, or it ground out to something and it burnt up the alternator and a good part of the wiring harness.
Ah, God.
And I'm sitting in the car thinking, I don't have my extinguisher with me.
I will put this out with my mind if I have to.
I was going
to
use something else. I was going to stand on a tire first and give her a shot.
Like putting out a fire when you were in the Boy Scouts.
Yeah.
It's entertaining as hell, but
I'll hose this down.
It's not nice.
And I was sitting there going, son of a bitch, son of a bitch, son of a bitch, son of a bitch, son of a bitch.
How did it go out? I mean,
you know, the driving gloves I've got?
Yeah.
I was wearing those, ran over, grabbed the battery cables and yanked them off the terminal, yanked them off the post. So it no longer had any juice to continue.
Yeah.
And it stopped right then.
But, damn, dude.
Oh, man, just scared the hell out of me.
Well, yeah.
And got to sit there on a Sunday morning waiting for AAA to come collect me and deliver the car home. Oh, and then Monday morning, put it on another truck and send it to Daryl. So if your Dodge isn't being worked on immediately, I might be part of that problem.
I can almost hear him right now. He must be feeling this show.
That's awesome. Pick Automotive, the 5920 Merriam Drive in Merriam, Kansas, folks. 66203.
Ossipik Automotive.
Yeah, you can tell how much my crappy works on. I've got all this stuff memorized. I'm not reading that off a card.
Hard to say and easy to low. Ossipik Automotive.
Right off the top of my head, 913-831-3613. The Schadenfreude Express, the 99 Mercedes S600, is nearing mechanical completion.
Hot diggity.
We're almost done with that. Got all the... I sourced all the parts and everything on it is working so far. We need an antenna so that the radio will work.
Well, hell yeah.
And I found that this afternoon, and it's coming. It will be here this week.
Well, can't you just put a cassette in there and let it rock?
Well, I got a rebuilt version of the factory Becker stereo that's in it that has Bluetooth. So now
what?
I can listen to any damn thing that's on my phone.
All right.
And the other thing is the rear... spindle suspension, the spindle bushings are shot, and that's why the car creaks. So we're replacing that. And of course, it's something that's a pain in the butt to get to and expensive to replace. And that's okay. I'm spending my children's inheritance.
Yeah. Well, the hardest part is that thing, the blinker fluid on that is so expensive.
Uh-huh. And the exhaust bushings.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Anyway, almost have that thing put together, and then I have to start going through the cosmetic stuff. But by God, I'm going to do what people say is the impossible, which is reviving a W140 platform that has had years worth of neglect. The upside is I can remember when it was great and before my dad stuck it in the warehouse and let it sit forever. But she's coming back. She's coming back. And my dad keeps saying, I can't wait to drive it. And I keep thinking,
Das ist the labor of love, yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm going to have to let him drive it. He gave me the damn thing. So,
nice.
Anyway, and that has nothing to do with your Dodge because it's being worked on at a completely different shop. Now, could I have done a lot of this stuff myself? Yeah, probably. Do I want to replace that wiring harness on the 65 by myself?
No.
I'm sure I could figure it out, and I'm sure that I like keeping Daryl Ossipik at Ossipik Automotive.
Yeah, rolling in the dough, baby. He's making some money off of this show.
I told him I was doing that. He says, don't do that. I don't have enough help as it is. I'm buried. Don't do that. So 5920 Merriam Drive in Merriam, Kansas.
Oh, my God. I don't think I'll ever be driving that Dodge.
Hey, our special guest this week is Ed Fallon. Ed has been immersed in the world of collector cars for 4 decades, operating Cave Creek Classics, a high-end boutique dealership in Arizona. Ed specializes in French marks such as Voisin, Hispano Suiza, Delahaye, as well as American classics like Duesenberg, all the really pretty, super cool stuff.
So sexy.
Early in his career, Ed represented car auctions in Monterey for the late Don Williams of the Blackhawk Collection, as well as Barrett Jackson. He's worked with Paris-based Art Curiel Auctions for the last 13 years and has provided consulting services to many of the big names in the collector world. In his spare time, Ed can be found in the Arizona desert firing off live rounds from his 1943 white M16A2 half track, or cooking a gourmet meal in his home on a private island off the coast of Minnesota. What a cool guy. Ed, welcome to Driven Radio.
Thanks, guys.
So that's quite a resume, Ed. Were you a car fan from the very beginning? Who were your early influences?
I guess probably my father. My mother said to me that before I was born, he had found a sad-faced Murray pedal car and was under my crib before I was born. That might have been the start of it. But he had a 30 Chrysler sedan. And I remember as a real young kid, I had short pants on. And he put me in the back seat. We were going to go for a ride. And I remember sitting on that mohair and thought that was poking me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it smelled like an old car. And then subsequently sold that. And then as I got older, I kept begging him, yeah, we need to get an old car. We need to get an old car. And one day he brought home a little Model A Ford pickup truck.
Oh, how
and
fun.
It just started from there. And so we had some cars. And as I got older, I started playing with cars and started collecting Minnesota license plates. Well, that leads you to the junkyard to find plates. And so I would look at all those old cars and pull plates and this and that and say, geez, I like this one. I like that one. And that's when the junkers were cool. You know,
yeah,
they had cool stuff in them. And so it kind of went from there. And by the time I was in high school, I was buying and selling John Deere tractors and rebuilding them and selling them. And then I got out of school and scrap was getting up to be about $30 a ton and the oil embargo hit and all the big cars of the big blocks. I'd buy station wagons with some of the guys that did the demolition derbies and I'd buy cars and run over the scale. I ran so much stuff over the scale. It's a sin now.
What was your first car?
My first car I bought was a little junk Morris Minor.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, I bought it from a guy for like, I don't know, 25, 30 bucks, and I sold it for like 50 bucks to a guy. And then I bought a 1947 Nash Ambassador, a 600 from the original owner. And I had that car for quite a while, and you know, and then it just went from there.
Have you always worked in the car world?
No, well, I started with the cars, you know, back in the 70s, you know, all through school and that kind of a thing. But I worked in an auto parts store. And that was helpful. You know, back then we had to read the books. You didn't have a computer, you know, you had cross-reference stuff. And so I did that. And then in 1985, there was a man here, George Zacco, and his wife, Fran. And they started a place that was a storage place, but it also had a showroom there. It was called the Toy Store. And I said to George, I said, who are you going to have run this? He goes, I don't know. I'm taking some applications on some retired guys. And I said, what do they know about old cars? And he kind of laughed. And so I said, can I put my application in? He goes, yeah. So anyway, they hired me. So I arrived and there was nothing there, a showroom. And I started putting ads in to get consignments. And the first car I took in was a 65 Mustang little coupe. And it had hail damage on it. The hood looked like Lake Minnetonka. I mean, it always gets this and that. And I was pretty happy that we got a car for sale, you know. And anyway, George comes in. He goes, where did you get that? And I said, a guy brought it in to sell it. You know, I got it on consignment. He's paying $100 a month or this or that or whatever. And I said, we can sell it. He goes, get it out of here. I only want good cars. Call the guy. Take it back. I said, okay. Well, I wasn't going to call the guy back. Well, anyway, lo and behold, this guy comes in, gotten out of the army. And he goes, dude, I'm looking for a Stang. And I said, well, I just happen to have one.
What do you know?
And we walked in the back and I sold him the car. And George comes in the next day and he says to me, he goes, Ed, I see you called that guy, got rid of the Mustang. I said, no, I didn't. I said, here's a check. I sold the car. So it went from there.
How did you go from there to being involved in the collector car world? And by that, I mean more like what you're working with now.
Well, I mean, I used to go to Iola Wisconsin to the big car show back in the day and, you know, sell parts and go to the swap meet and do that and do the car corral. And so I would meet, you know, guys. And then as I started to work at the toy store full time, then, you know, I'd go to the auctions in the Twin Cities and I'd start to go to Auburn, Indiana. But I always wanted to go to Barrett-Jackson. And so I think it was like 87 or 88 was the first year that I went to Barrett-Jackson. And I went with Duffy Schamburger. I didn't have a lot of money. And Duffy said to me, he said, because he had Duffy's Collectible Cars. I don't even remember him from Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Yeah.
And Diamond Gloss Paint. Remember his ads? Mm-hmm. Anyway, Duff's still around. I saw him in Arizona here not too long ago. But anyway, Duffy said, you can come and stay with me. So here we got a hotel on 24th Street and Van Buren in Arizona, in Phoenix. And I don't know if you guys know what that's like, but it's a nasty, bad neighborhood.
Yeah.
I mean, the girls are working out front, okay?
The waitresses? So, got it.
Yeah, the waitresses, yeah. And so we paid $120 a week to stay in the hotel.
Wow.
Okay. And then we go to Barrett-Jackson, and we would, you know, he'd buy some cars, and then cars didn't sell back then, and so then you'd, you know, curb them or you'd buy them, and we end up buying, you know, 20-30 cars, and then he'd ship them back to his dealership and I'd take some on consignment for the toy store or this or that or whatever. And so it started from there. And then after that I started going to some of the events in Las Vegas, and then Don Williams and Richie Klein did the first The Auction, which was a no reserve sale, the first actual no reserve auction. So I went there and I saw guys that were doing what they were terming appraisals. But what they were doing, they were writing results down on the block. Then there was a guy named Chris Zora, another guy named Brian Nelson Jones. I don't know if you remember those guys, but they were the first ones that were kind of writing down auction results. There was another old guy, Ray, that used to have a, they'd publish a book, you know, like a CPI kind of guy, you know, that had the auction results for the year, and that's what you would buy. And so I made up a jacket that said Fallon Appraisal Service on the back. And I just walked in there to the auction and said, yeah, I'm going to here and write down the stuff. And the other guys were like, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm just going to write down the stuff like you're doing. So I did. Well, then I got to meet all the players and the people and whatever. And then Brian Jackson saw me there and came up to me and he goes, hey, what do you know? And I told him what I did and this and that. And he goes, well, we're going to start a salon at Barrett-Jackson. And this would have been, I don't know, maybe 92. And Don Williams had done his salon or exposition in Japan in 91 and it was pretty successful. And so Brian hired me to come and work in the salon series where the cars were for sale statically rather than going over the block. And that's how I got started at Barrett-Jackson.
Most people, a lot of car guys, never get around to being involved with some of the high-end stuff you do. And I'm kind of wondering if being around Don Williams is what spurred your interest in Delahaye, Delage, Duesenberg, and Hispano Suiza, and other cars of that ilk.
I would read the ads, and you used to see, you know, Tom Barrett, you know, the greatest name in classic cars, and he would put his ads in, and you would look at the cars that he had for sale. Then you'd see stuff about Don, and you'd see things are going on. And I always wanted to work at the Blackhawk collection. So when I got to work at Barrett-Jackson, Don obviously, you know, worked with Tom Barrett and with the Jacksons. And so that's how he met me. And he saw me sell some cars right away. And then he approached me. And so he hired me to work at his events because they were doing auctions, you know, the Bay Area and down on the coast in California and this and that. And then he would have the exposition at the Peter Hay Golf Course at Pebble and those kinds of things. And I finally went to work for Don full time in 95 for a number of years. And then I went back to Barrett-Jackson again after that. But Don was my mentor. Don was the one that he always said to me, he goes, you know, I took the boy out of Minnesota, but I could never take Minnesota out of the boy. And he goes, Ed, you can talk to any of these guys that bring a car in and you're right on their level, whatever it might be. And Don was from Santa Monica, so he was kind of a California boy, you know. And he was like, you get along with these guys so well and you can talk to them and you're on, you know, they could be the richest guy that's an industrialist and you guys are talking about John Deere tractors or something, you know.
How did you become a recognized specialist with some of those cars?
Well, I think that basically, I mean, when you're exposed to everything, doing all the events, I mean, there was a point in time where I was pretty much a hired gun, and I worked for Cruz and I worked for Don. I helped Haggerty get established. You know, their first outing at Auburn, Indiana was with Megan Maddie, and it was raining. They had a table trying to get set up. McKeel was still in a seminary, and Frank and Louise had approached me and Arizona because the SNL hit in 91 and they were extended on insuring some of the Ferraris for, you know, way more than they were probably valued at.
Sure.
And so he had to kind of redo those things, you know? And so, but everybody used to say to me, cause I'd go to an auction, I was there, you know, at something every month. And people would just say to me, well, who are you working for this weekend? Who are you working for this weekend? You know, because that's what I did. I was, you know, either selling or representing someone or, you know, a business or whatever, and collectors, you know, I would, you know, Dick Gold, great collector, president of the Classic Car Club for Minneapolis. He gave him my first Duesenberg in like, I don't know, 88, 89 to bring to Auburn to get it verified. And he's like, Ed, you know, here you are. You're what? I don't know, 27, 28 years old. And you've got a, you know, $750,000 car and you're going to Auburn, Indiana and drive it around because Dick's not going. I mean, it was awesome.
True that.
You know, I mean, Robbie and I, you know, you got to remember, you know, the Imperial Palace with Ralph Engelstadt, he had all the 770Ks there that were kept in the back, but he also had the Duesenberg collection. And Rick Carroll's collection got broke up. And so a lot of the Duesenbergs were on the market and the prices were moving and changing. And, you know, Dick here in Minneapolis, he had J107, the LeGrand, supercharged. That's in the Arturo Keller collection now. And it's probably one of the greatest Duesenbergs of all time. But he sold that to Tom Moynihan in like 87 for $1 million.
Wow. Right?
First Duesy to sell for $1 million. And so Dick was one guy in Minnesota had sold a car for $1 million. And it wasn't until, I don't know, 91 or 92. And I got the opportunity. I sold a 288 GTO in Duluth, Minnesota for the Paluchis, Chungking Chow Mein. Ever heard of that?
Yes, sir.
Yep.
Pino's Pizzas.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no kidding.
Oh, yeah. And there was a bunch of cars there. And I got a phone call from a guy named Andy Borg. And he goes, Ed, I want you to come up here and look at this Ferrari and see if you can sell it. And I said, all right. So I told George, the guy I worked for, I said, yeah, I got to go to Duluth and look at these cars. He goes, no, you're wasting your time. You know, I said, I'm going. And so I just locked the door and I went up and his kid came in and took over the store. And I got up there and I said to Andy, I said, I need to make a phone call. So I called Brian Jackson. I said, hey, I got this car. I don't want that thing. I don't want it. He goes, call Tony Carlini. So I called Carlini on the phone. He was the guy that mocked up the K cars for Lee Iacocca,
mm-hmm.
You know, because they only had three of them. They weren't real. I mean, you know, the Senate thought that they had all these cars. Well, no, they only had three. You know, and Carlini says, all right, I'll meet you there next week. Flew out. I sold it to him for $1,094,000. He docked me $6,000 because it hadn't been serviced.
Oh,
and the only one that beat me on it was Rick Cole sold one at Monterey that fall for $1,115,000. So I wasn't too far off.
Sounds like you were right on the ball. Can you discuss some of your other more significant sales? And I've got quite a laundry list here, and it's pretty eye-opening.
Well, I don't know. It's back in the day. I mean, you'll see a gap there from the 288 GTO to like, what, 97?
Yeah.
You know, the SNL hit. Yeah, the SNL hit, you know, all of that. Japanese were buying stuff, you know. And things weren't 100%, and we weren't selling really big cars on the block. So a lot of that stuff was hand sold. You know, it was, you know,
yeah,
to a person, and you had the salon where they could come and look at the cars, which I always found really good. That's what I liked. I liked hand selling, and more so than just getting it on the block, because you got an opportunity to go through the car, you know, and even you know, take it out and drive it if you wanted to, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, when I got hired at Blackhawk, I said to Don, I said, I want to sell my first Duesenberg. So that would be the one, the convertible sedan. I sold it to Dave Lindsay in Wisconsin. I took, I don't know, 25 Corvettes and a 31 Cadillac in trade. And, you know, and he had it forever. And it was a good car. And then, what was his name? I can't remember. No, anyway, so another guy that I knew, Bill Shorkey. he called me on the phone. He goes, Ed, I sold my Murphy convertible coupe. And he goes, I want it back. But the guy I sold it to, I don't like. So you see if you can get my car back. And I said, okay. All right. And so I called the guy on the phone. I said, you know, I got a guy that really liked to buy that car. And, you know, would you consider selling? He goes, well, Ed, I guess at the right price. And I said, well, what do you think? And we talked. And I said, well, let me see what I can do. And I called him back. He goes, yeah, get it. You know, so I bought it. Well, that was J330. And so I sold it to him. And Bill got the car back. And he was happy. And then I found out about J331, another Murphy convertible coupe. And I sold that to Dr. Charles Key, and I had to fly to Maine, belong to an old junkyard dealer up there, and he flew in his jet, and I met him at the airport and sold him the car, and I was like, I'm on a roll. I did J30, J330, I did J331, now I need J332.
Yeah.
didn't work out that way.
On J330... What did it sell for? And then what were you able to buy it back for?
Oh, I don't remember. J330.
I know what you bought it back for. I'm wondering what the difference was between sale and buying it back.
It probably wasn't that much. I mean, it was probably like 50, you know, 50 to, it wouldn't have been over 100,000. You know what I mean?
Okay.
In those days, it wouldn't have been, you know, crazy, crazy.
Well, still, that's a, you know, that's $1,999. It's when you bought it back, it was $775 in '99. That's still a pile of money.
Yeah, but that's kind of where those cars were at, you know. And one was a disappearing top, and one was a non-disappearing top. So there's a difference in pricing there.
Was 331 the non-disappearing top?
Because 330 looks like just a convertible.
Yeah, I think 330 was a disappearing top. It, you know, it's been so long, I you know, I don't remember exactly, but we can look them up.
And that same year, 99, you did the J30, you did J331, you had a 1935 Mercedes 500K Sport Roadster,
right?
That went for extraordinary money,
right? That was a special roadster, sport roadster. It was the only one with a folding flat windshield. It was on the cover of Barrett Jackson. We had it for sale in the salon, but I think I ended up selling it after the fact. So,
okay,
yeah, and that was a really good car. You know, that was a really good car.
The next year, a 1928 Mercedes S Erdmann Rossi Tour.
Yeah, I got that car from a guy out of Texas. Now you're making me dig again. His name will come to me. But anyway, he was heavy into Pierce's, and he also was the guy that did Air Force One, you know, for the government. So he built all of that. He was really a nice guy. He got the car out of New York, and it was tip top perfect, nice. And I got it, and Eberhard Thiessen, because I had been going to Retromobile now, so I, you know, had been working a lot in Europe, and I knew a lot of the dealers there. And Eberhard Thiessen was going to do a stand at Essen for Erdmann and Rossi coachwork. So he asked me if I'd bring the car for sale. I said, yes, I would. So we put it on a ship and, you know, in a container, and it was going there. And then my friend Axel Schutte called me from Germany, and he goes, Ed, my client wants to buy that car. So I sold the car on the water before it got to the show. Went to Essen, we put it on the stand, and then we showed it to the new buyer.
Oh, no kidding.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
It wasn't even at the show. It was, you know, one guy had the buyer and one guy had it, you know. So, I mean, everybody got a little piece of the pie, you know.
Nice.
You also had a 1929 Duesenberg Murphy convertible sedan in 2000, a 34 Duesenberg Brun Riviera in 2000. Yeah. Boy, you were busy.
Well, the Brun was kind of a funny story. I'm in Auburn, Indiana. I'm standing on the block, and I had looked at the Brun Riviera, and they made, I think, like three of them, you know? And the car was there, and it was going over the block. And I didn't really have any money, but Craig had some money at the time, right? But Craig hadn't given me authorization to buy anything. So I'm standing on the block, and the block's there, and or the car's there, and I was in it at, like, I don't know, 400, and it was, you know, back and forth. And anyway... I bid it to, I think I was at 500, I think it was. And all of a sudden, boom, they're at 650, 675. And I'm like, what is going on here? You know, yeah. I mean, who's bidding? I can't see. And Bruce Knox comes running up. That's who was working with Dean Cruz at the time. He goes, Eddie, were you in on that car at like around 500? I said, yeah, basically. But I said, all of a sudden, you guys were at 60. Well, Dean went past the money, and he's past the money. And I said, well, that's not my problem. He goes, no, no, no. You know, and he goes, no, no, no. He goes, I'm going to go up there. And he goes, I'll write you a ticket for 500, and we're going to call it sold at 650, but you're going to pay 500. I said, all right, I'll do that. So anyway, they went up there. He told Dean, whispered in his ear, and they sold it 650, right? So everybody's kind of looking at me like, wow, Ed, you paid a lot for that, you know? And guys are coming to me and they said, wow, we, you know, a little surprised at what you pay for that. I'm like, yeah, yeah, whatever. You know, well, Craig didn't know I bought it. Now I'm on the hook.
Oh boy.
So I call Craig on the phone. I'm like, are you ready? He goes, what? I said, I bought a Duesenberg. He goes, you what? And I said, yeah, I need $500,000. He's like, are you crazy? I'm like, well, you got money. And he's like, are you nuts? I said, well, I'll figure it out. I mean, you know, whatever. Don't worry. We'll figure it out, you know. It's like, okay. Well, then Brian Joseph comes up to me, the Duesenberg explorer out of Michigan, right? He says to me, he goes, Eddie, what just happened there? He goes, did you buy that car? I said, yeah, I bought the car. He goes, you didn't pay that. I said, well, oh, what's that got to do with it? My client wants the car. I said, all right. I said, I'll sell it to you right now. I'll hand you the ticket. He goes, what will it take? I said, $550. He goes, okay, sold. So I called Craig back. I said, all right, don't worry about digging under the bed. I said, I got it handled.
God. He wasn't upset, was he?
No, no, I'm bringing home a check for $50,000. I only get a percentage of that.
He likes you.
Oh, yeah, he was happy.
You also, you sold a 1934 Rolls-Royce Round Door for $1 million in 2001, and that's a really unique-looking car.
Well, that's the car that's at the Petersburg Museum. That's the Jacques Renet. You know the Round Door Rolls-Royce?
Only by pictures. I've never seen it in the flesh.
Okay, now it's black. Originally, it was kind of a gold color. Then it sat in a junkyard out east. And then it belonged to Bob Bayer. All right. Then Tom Barrett got it. And he had 55-gallon drums of white paint at the time. So he painted it white. And it went to the exposition with Don in 91 in Japan. And it got sold to a man named Nakajima-san. So Nakajima bought it. He was a big car dealer in Japan. Everywhere you went, you see Nakajima cars. They had a big N. And anyway, Akira Takai, my partner at the time, Nakajima wanted to sell it. And everybody had been after the car. And we were kind of in it. And Charlie Bronson, and he's still sore over this deal. But anyway, Charlie Bronson had gone to Bob Peterson at the Peterson Museum and showed him a model and said, you got to buy this car. We can get it in Japan, blah, 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 and this and that. Well, Peterson didn't like Charles's, you know, maybe his presentation or something. And so he got real uptight. Well, anyway, Dick Messer, Peterson's guy at the museum at the time, called Craig and said, hey, can you get the Round Door Rolls-Royce? And Craig came to me and he goes, can you get it? I said, yeah, we can get it. And he goes, can you buy it? And I said, yeah, we can buy it. I said, so anyway, Akira and I did the deal with Nakajima-san, and we bought the car. And then we jerked around with the Peterson Museum because Dick Messer was going to buy an airplane and fly it and do this and do that. And I was like, God, this guy just does give up, you know. And finally we got it shipped, and it came. And they did the restoration on it. The only thing, I mean, it's really not my problem, but, you know, they took off the bumpers on the front and the back. They still have them, but, I mean, it had big bumpers on it, but they took it off, you know. It is the car. I mean, it's a cool, cool, cool car. It's the only one.
It's interesting to see the pictures with the bumpers on it because it does change that profile. And it looks gorgeous.
It does change it.
Yeah. You know, and that's the one that the first time I ever heard of that vehicle, I had seen a picture of it in a junkyard. Right. And I'm like, yep. Oh my God, this beautiful piece of machinery sat somewhere rotting. How could... Yep. There's no redneck stupid enough to let that happen. And and then I saw what it became, and I'm like, oh yeah, that works. I wish they had kept the bumpers on it.
You're right. Well, you know, maybe they should show it both ways, but you know what? Really, when they took the bumpers off, it kind of cleaned it up, don't you think?
It does.
Yeah.
It's got a little cleaner lines without them.
It's a little more gangster.
And I think the black was the right
that
choice
was
of
a
color.
Good choice, yeah, with that red Absolutely. Interior.
Well, either black or a dark blue would have been really cool also, but it looks very sleek.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a super impressive car. I mean, you know, and the windows are round and they open like a fan down.
That is insane. I applause. Golf clap. That is awesome.
Very cool. A lot of the stuff we've been talking about comes from Europe or other parts of the world. What's the process of bringing a car into the U.S.? And what do you think people would be surprised to know about shipping rare cars internationally?
Well, it's not as hard as I guess most people think. I mean, during the pandemic, I mean, shipping prices went crazy. But, you know, normally it's not that horrible, you know, for a container or this or that. You just want to get with a good, you know, a good company that's going to do it. If you're going to, now I'm talking old cars now. I'm not talking like late model. Remember in the day where they used to bring in like gray market Mercedes and all that kind of thing? Yeah, okay. So there's certain things that you can't bring in because they're not, you know, DOT, EPA, you know, certified, right?
Yeah. Fun
and
stuff.
And now Mercedes and those companies, I think, have kind of made the cars like, okay, here's the American versions and here's the other world versions, you know?
Yeah.
So, but if you were to bring an old car back here, if it's made in the United States, it's 2.5%. If it's made in the United States and you bring it back here, it's zero. But if you bring a, let's say a Delahaye or a Delage or something like that, it's 2.5% customs duty here.
Okay.
So it's not that horrible.
Yeah. $100,000 car is $2,500. $1 million car is $25,000.
Exactly. And then if you're going the other way, let's say that, okay, like my Voisin, for instance, you know, I could have probably brought it back to France to sell it because that's where it was born, but it was sold here in the United States new. So it doesn't have a carte de grise or it doesn't have history of being in the EU. So if I was to bring it back, there'd be a 7% and then probably a 19% VAT on top of it.
Oh, my.
Wow.
So you got to look at the dynamics going both ways. You know what I mean?
You know, you still see those cars, especially I'm the world's biggest bring a trailer junkie and kind of goes with the territory because I write for Sports Car Market. You still see like rest of world 911s that turn up on bring a trailer or rest of world. You'll see gray market Mercedes 560 SECs that came with the full 300 horsepower because they were originally sold in Europe or Japan rather than being sold here. You still run into that stuff. And I think the manufacturers finally got it through their heads. Make one car for everywhere. And you don't have to worry about doing the different emissions and doing all of that stuff. And I think now, correct me if I'm wrong, isn't Europe tougher on emissions than the U.S.?
Probably are. I mean, I know in France, I mean, they, you know, even in Paris, you know, driving around, the cars have to be a certain age and this and that. So, yeah, a lot of that is, you know, getting much tougher.
Yeah. Yeah. You've represented or consulted for numerous groups and companies. How did you get started as a consultant? And can you tell us for some of the people you've worked for?
I don't know. It's just a name. You know, it's like you get a business card. And it's like, I'm the CEO, I'm the CFO, I'm the big kahuna. It's like, so pick something that's pretty, you know, plain is what I always said. Or don't even put a title on there. Because once you put a title on there, everybody's shooting at you, you know? I mean, do you want to be number one? No, I want to be number two. I don't want to be the top of the guy on the pole. I don't.
I want to be the third guy down. I won't have to answer any real questions.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't want to be the top dog because everybody's always after the top dog. It's like, nice. I just want to move around, do what I got to do and just do it quietly. And so, I mean, consultant is just a good term. I mean, I can help people if they, you know, need representation at an auction or if they want to, you know, ship a car or, you know, and usually what I do is just steer them in the right direction. and assist them in what they need to do. And you know, I don't really do that much in appraisals anymore. I mean, that's pretty much static now. I mean, everybody's doing all the auction results. You've got all these different things. I mean, with the internet, I mean, I started out, it was snail mail with pictures and you sent them in the mail. That's how you sold cars.
You know? Yep.
I mean, I used to walk around a Pebble with two little briefcases and we had 8x10 pictures of what I had for sale at Blackhawk. Oh, and wow. I would just whip out my books and we start, you know, going through the pictures, because we didn't have cell phones with pictures. We didn't have any of that stuff. You know, we got a fax machine. We thought we were cool.
Dude, I remember wearing a beeper for a while for the radio station that I worked with. And I thought I was top dog when I heard a beep and said, sorry, I got to check my beeper. Jesus. Oh, there's a telephone number. Now I got to go find a phone to call.
You know, exactly. That hasn't been all that long ago.
Feels like it.
Really hasn't been all that long ago. I'll get into that later.
Yeah.
But hadn't been that long. For the uninitiated, what is art curial and what is its significance?
Well, art curial is an auction house based in Paris. We're right on the Champs-Élysées at what they call the Hotel Dassault, which is, Dassault is the family. You ever heard of Dassault aircraft?
Yes.
All the fighter jets, all of that stuff?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's like their historical family home, obviously like two blocks down from the Arc de Triomphe, right on the Champs-Élysées. So, I mean, It's nice digs. You know what I mean? So Arc Curiel was formed about 13 years ago where three or four auction houses got together. So there was Tajan, and then there was Poulain Le Four. And so these different auction, Brest, and I can't remember the other one, it gives with the O. Anyway, they formed Art Curiel. And so Art Curiel does paintings, they do, you know, furniture, they do jewelry, they do all these things. So it's a full line auction house, but we have the motor car division, the motor car department.
Yeah.
And so my boss or my good friend is Matthew Lamour. And I've known Matthew since he was with Poulain Le Four, you know, back in the day. And then he went to work for Bonhams. And then after Bonhams, then he came back and he went to work with Hervé Poulain, the guy that started the BMW art cars in Le Mans.
Yeah.
He's our auctioneer. Okay. Yep. And I started, you know, working with them. And I just kind of became, let's say, the American correspondent or the American consultant. So, and I like my position because I'm one of the only guys that really went from the United States to Europe, where most of the experts come from Europe to here to work for the auction companies.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. True. True. Do you currently work with other auction houses or companies?
Not really. I mean, I have good relationships, I think, with most everybody. I can get a hold of anybody if I need to. You know, they'll call me once in a while about a car that might have passed through my hands or if they want information or that kind of a thing if they've got questions. But right now I'm pretty happy with what I'm doing. And I think that you're, you know, I guess I'm a little loyal to a fault. Don used to say that too. You know, it's like, you know, after I did where I was doing it every month for everybody differently, I thought it was best that I just stick with, you know, what I'm doing and not try to mix it up.
Tell us about your 1943 white M16A2 half track. How in the hell does somebody come to own a half track?
Well, I guess the idea of the half track, when I was young, my uncle Leo served in the Second World War, and he was in the Armored Infantry Battalion in the 12th Armored Division, and he was in. Went to France and obviously in Germany and ended up in Austria and that kind of a thing. But he was Armored Infantry Battalion, so they would have tanks and half tracks and that kind of a thing. And so he would ride on a half track. And so he used to tell me stories about during the war. And, you know, he didn't talk a lot about it, but he would always tell me about the half tracks. And, you know, as a kid, you're watching combat, you're watching Rat Patrol,
you're watching
that stuff. Huh?
Yeah,
I
mean,
when I was. Yeah. You guys are probably younger than I am. So
not,
you know,
not that much. You
know. Okay. So, but anyway, you know, we used to watch that stuff. I mean, Rat Patrol in color, man, that was a big deal.
Yeah, it was
1965. You know, so anyway, so I'd see them, and I always wanted one. And anyway, I never had it. So I was at our Curiel and we got a military collection. And I was sitting there on the podium, you know, around the, you know, phones or whatever. And this thing came up for sale and there was like no money on it. So I raised my hand and Matthew looked at me like, are you bidding on this? I said, yeah. So I bought it. I was like the only bid, you know? So then I called Martin Button. Oh yeah, we can ship it. No problem. Blah, blah, blah. So first letter I get was from the French government saying, this is an implement of war and are you going to sell it to a third world country?
Okay, I guess that makes sense, kind of.
I said, no, it's going to my personal collection. All right, then it gets shipped. It ends up in Long Beach, and the government had gone on a shutdown. I get a letter from the State Department saying, this was lend-lease, blah, blah, blah. We usually don't allow it back. It's an implement of war, and what's your intention with it? And I'm like, it's for my personal collection. I bought it. There's no gun mounts on it, so don't worry about it, you know? Well, it's still armored, and it's an implement of war. I'm like, yeah, whoop-de-doo. I said, if you shot it with a 50 caliber machine gun, it looked like a piece of Swiss cheese. They call them Purple Heart boxes for a reason.
Oh, God. You
know? So it languished in customs at $300 a day for 90 days.
Jesus Christ.
So my good deal was getting worse and worse. And Martin said to me, he goes, Ed, just let the government have it and they'll put it up for sale and you can buy it at auction. I'm like, no, I ain't going to let it go. I went this far. So I finally got it and I got it back to Phoenix. And then my friend Joe Sikorsky and I, you know, we put a new clutch in it, did this, did that. It runs and drives really good. And it's fun. And I mean, it's just, it's off the wall. And I've got a 50 caliber fully automatic machine gun that I put on top.
And that was the next question is what ammo does it fire? And if it's a fully auto 50 cal, that took a little bit of wrangling. Let's see, is that class four or series? I'm trying to remember
It's a form four gun. So yeah, it's a fully transferable gun. Yeah. You just pay your $250 tax stamp. It's no big deal and buy the gun.
Well, what do you do when the ATF comes around and wants to do their annual inspection? Hey, we got to go out in the desert.
The stuff has to be kept at the proper address that you have down for them. And if they want to see it, you open up the door and go, there's the gun.
Yeah. Well, I bet there isn't a deer around that lake.
No, he keeps it in Arizona. Jackrabbits.
Arizona, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, there it's not.
You lit up the 50 up here, you'd have the whole state on fire. You know, shoot it in the desert.
Yeah, take it down to Arizona, use it on javelinas.
Now, for the listeners who don't really know, the white is not actually the color.
No,
that's the manufacturer. It is a big honking mean looking. I love the kind of wide and flat profile that it has, especially for the cab. And then, is yours the convertible top too? That over the top of the cab is just canvas.
Well, mine was originally an M16, and so it had the 450 calibers in the back.
Yeah, and that's a picture I'm looking at right now of one. Right,
okay, and no, 450s.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. There's four, it's on this kind of turret thing that moves around.
Right, exactly. It's got a pulpit. That's run by a Briggs & Stratton engine. It's got a pulpit, and a guy sits in it, and he moves it around. They call them meat choppers.
Oh, I want one of these.
My half track served in the Second World War. It came back to the United States, a company called B&M rebuilt the engine, and then they fixed my folding sides up, and they put it on a taller ring mount so they could get a better depression for firing. And then it was sent back probably overseas, either to Germany or Korea, I don't know. And then it went into the French Army, because we got rid of half-tracks in about 1958. So it went into the French Army. They took the quad out of the back and then put missiles in it.
Oh, God.
So it had missiles in it. I think it probably served in Algeria. And then it came back to France. They took the missile launcher out of it and put it in a museum. And that museum went out of business. And then that's when I bought it. So it served in two different armies. And it's never been apart, really. It's all original armor.
What they had was a 400-gallon espresso machine in the back of it because France. Yep. It rolled around and served.
No. I'm a little surprised you left this in Arizona and didn't take it to Minnesota. This thing looks like it'd be perfect for your snow.
Oh, it would be. It would be. Yeah. It's heavy. It's a heavy girl, but it's a lot of fun. And we go to the big Sandy machine gun shoot, which is the largest machine gun shoot in Arizona. It's a big range that's privately held.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's kind of one of the things on your bucket list. Like if you go to, you go to Retromobile where we have our auction, or if you go to, the Le Mans Historiques, or you go to Essen, or you go to, you know, Monaco, those kinds of things. Big Sandy is where you can see almost any type of machine gun on the planet that's being shot. You know, it's cool.
Fun.
And now let's see, where's the other big machine gun shoot? It's in Kentucky, isn't it?
They quit Knob Creek.
Every weekend.
Did they really? When did that happen?
A few years ago. They were in too tight and they were having trouble and people were getting hurt. So it got shut down. They got rid of it.
Oh, that's too bad. That's a shame. All right. Well, how does one come to own their own island?
Well, my parents bought some land up on Elbow Lake in like the mid-60s, and we've been there, and there was a little island across from us, and it was always with the same family, and it was never for sale. Many people tried to buy it, and I was in Germany, and my mom called me and said, Pine Island just went up for sale, and I quick called the realtor, and I said, I want to buy it, and she goes, you got to write a letter to the lady as to why you want to own it. I said, okay. So I wrote her a nice letter as to I'd been watching the island and this and that. I'd really like to own it. Why? And this and that, whatever. And I made her an offer. And other guys were trying to buy it and offer her more money. And anyway, the realtor called me back. She goes, she loved your letter and you own it. And so I have it. And it's right across from my family's property. And it's cool.
Nice.
Do you have I assume there's a house on Pine Island?
I have a small little cabin there. It's not very huge. I'll sell a few of my cars. I've got my Voisin to sell, and I still got my 32 Panhard Levasseur. And so I don't know why I've got all these sleeve valves, but you know.
So listen up, kids. If you want to keep your trick-or-treaters down to a minimum and you don't want anybody knocking on your front door trying to sell you something, buy an island.
Yeah, exactly.
Mark and I are kind of curious when you're going to let us come visit.
Yeah.
Anytime you want. Doesn't matter. Let me know.
I was waiting for him to say off season when the snow is 3 feet deep.
Yeah, come on by. We can walk to it.
You split time between your island and the Arizona desert?
Yeah, well, pretty much. I mean, I've got a motor coach. And I go up to the lake and then I travel. So, I mean, I'll be in Monaco here. We've got a big auction coming up in May. In Monaco, we've got a collection. It's May 9th, and we've got 44 cars that belong to one man. And there's 26 Porsches, and everything's no reserve. Oh. There's two 300 SLs. There's a 58 Ferrari 250 GT, you know, California Spider long wheelbase. So it's going to be a nice, nice event. And so
I got money for airfare.
Yeah. I'm really happy this year. I've got two clients that were accepted to be on the field at Pebble Beach. And so I'm really excited about that. And then I'm going to have a car in with David Gooding for sale. But I'll give you a tip. There's a car that's going to go to Pebble, and it's going to be in one of the classes. And it's a 1966 Serenissima Spider.
Okay.
You're the experts.
Not on that, I'm not.
Well, in 1966, you probably heard of Ford and Ferrari, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, in Le Mans?
Yes.
All right, well, Count Filippi was a guy that had a lot of money, and he used to buy cars from Enzo Ferrari. And then him and Enzo kind of got into an argument about things, and so...
Enzo seemed to do that with a lot of people.
Well, his wife had a little bit to do with it, too. But you remember the Exodus where Pizzarini and all the guys left?
Oh,
all
yeah. Right,
well, they formed ATS, and they built, what, 6, 7, 8 cars, maybe with ATS, and Filippi had put money into ATS. Well, it only lasted for about a year, 2 years kind of thing, and he still wanted to race, so he formed his own company, Serenissima, and he built a car for Le Mans, and it raced for a number of hours, but then it blew the transmission. And the car was taken from Le Mans, from the pits, and put in his castle in Italy, and it stayed there until about 4 years ago, and it got sold at Art Curiel. And it sold for a considerable amount of money to a good client of mine here in Minnesota. And so he's got this thing squared away now, and it's going to go to Pebble, but this will be the first time this car has been heard running since 1966.
Wow.
I mean, how cool is that? And it's going to be presented as it came off the track.
That's I'm looking at a picture of it right now, and what a cool looking car.
Man, it is very cool. I mean, it's way ahead of its time. Look at it.
Yeah. Good Lord. And it's still got, it's got all natural rust. So it's a,
well, no, it was,
it's underneath a survivor.
There's no rust on it. I mean, it's just, it was taken off the track and put away. That was it.
Wow. Oh, that is so fun.
It's going to be so cool.
And it, and there's another picture of it where the whole back part flips up to be able to get to the engine. That is so cool.
Clamshell.
Yeah. Yeah. digging it hard. Oh, that was a part of, I think, a top or something that I thought was rust. It's actually just old. Oh, my God. Look at that engine. That is so sexy.
So in addition to having a half track, what are some of the more interesting cars you've had in your personal stable, either in the past or what do you have now? It sounds like you travel an awful lot. Do you have time for a collection?
Yeah, that's the problem with me is, I mean, I like stuff. I mean, I like hit and miss engines, you know, little one lungers and I like, you know, anything like that. But I have my 1924 Avion Voisin C4S. It's probably the only one known. I restored it to exactly how Voisin would have delivered it back in the day. So it's done to the nines. And I bought a 38 Peugeot Dalmat Special Sport Roadster back in the day from Frankie Dumontan and the guys in Europe, and I started researching Dalmat because no one had ever done a Dalmat right. And so I restored mine, and then Glenn Munger said to me, and I think it was 2004, he goes, Ed, you got to get your car done because we're doing a Paulin design class. You got to get your car done. And so I worked and I worked and I worked, and Lonnie Kruger and I worked, and we got it done. And the night before I'm supposed to ship it to Pebble, we went to start the engine and it hydraulically locked.
Oh, no.
The guy that had sleeved one of the cylinders didn't get it sealed right. And the guys looked at me and they said, Ed, you're not going to Pebble. I said, bullshit, we're not going to Pebble.
You watch me.
So we took the head off and we got JB Weld, and I JB Welded the head gasket to the head and let it dry on the way to Pebble.
Ran a can of seam foam through it.
And got it running. And I ended up winning my class at Pebble.
And oh my God!
Wow,
it was quite an achievement. I mean, I was extremely happy, and I remember I was unloading the car, and Jay Leno walked by, and he looked at me, and he goes, "Where did you get that?" I said, "I bought it in France." He goes, "Ed, that thing is awesome." You know? And when Jay says that it's awesome, you know it's good.
Yeah,
you know?
You've done good. You've done good.
So. No, a car that, I didn't really own it, but it was a car that, Akira and I found in Japan, is the 1927, Phantom that, was done by Clark and Wolverhampton. And have you guys ever seen the painted Rolls Royce?
Yes.
Okay. So it's got the fresco on the inside of the, you know, the ceiling in the car, and it's all done like Louis XIV on the inside.
Yes.
All right. See, I used to read AQ, you know, AQ, Automobile Quarter, religiously, you know, back in the day. I mean, it was one of the things I did, you know, like Hemmings Motor News. I mean, I subscribed to Hemmings Motor News in the 60s. And, you know, then the big deal with Hemmings was, oh, you got a brown wrapper on it. So their top pages weren't ripped off in the mail. Then they put it in a plastic bag and it was like, wow, we're really moving up in the world, you know. Oh, but I would see that car on Automobile Quarter, like, oh, man, you know, I just love that. But we get a phone call. We're in Tokyo, and Akira says, we got to go to Nagoya. And I said, why? And he goes, there's a Rolls Royce we got to look at. I said, what is it? He goes, it's a P1 town car. I said, we don't want one. I said, we just got four of them out of the Imperial Palace collection. We got a St. Albans and a St. this and a St. that and a St. whatever. I said, we can't even sell those. I said, are you nuts? But anyway, we go down there. And this Mercedes is waiting for us. We get in the back seat, drives us from the train station to this thing, and Akira pokes me and he goes, look at his fingers. Well, the guy had plastic fingers on two of his fingers. It was Yakuza. And, you know, and he probably wasn't a good one because he was missing part of his fingers. So anyway, he gets us to this car wash, and here sitting outside the car wash, covered, is that car. And I said to Akira, I said, I can't believe this. So they told us how much they wanted for it. And I said, we got to get back to Tokyo. We're on the bullet train. I called a client of mine. I said, listen, you got to buy this car now. You got to, you know. So I took a Type 57 Bugatti in on trade and money and sold them the Rolls. And I said to the Japanese, I said, listen, you've got to get it out of the country. Because I think because of who had it, there was probably some money deal going on there. And, you know, in Japan, there's no titles. It's just registration. So there is no title. And so Akira calls me on the phone about, I don't know, 3 weeks later. And I had told the guys that we got it from that I would put up 15 grand for shipping and this and that. And he called me. He goes, hey, they're not putting it in a ship. They're going to put it on an airplane. They're going to fly it. And I said, why? And he goes, don't ask. I said, all right. I said, okay.
Uh-huh.
So, and I said, all right. So I said, give them that money that I had set aside. He goes, no, I will. And I said, all right. So anyway, it was New Year's Eve, and the plane got loaded probably at a port under their auspices, and it flew to Seoul, Korea, and then it flew to San Francisco. It's New Year's Eve. I've got a truck standing by. And I said to Akira, I said, well, because the VIN number of the car was 76TC. I said, the paperwork here has got a 1989 Porsche VIN number on it. He goes, don't worry about it. Okay. Anyway, customs cleared it. It got in the truck and it went to my customer, and that was it.
Don't worry about it. I got a friend.
Then I sold it again to Charles Howard. And it's been back now in the market, but that is really one great car with a really great story. I mean, that is a really, really cool car.
It's interesting looking, too, because you've got the place where the chauffeur rides and they get to enjoy the rain. And then you've got that kind of boxed in cab. And there's pictures that I'm looking at of the interior of it, because when you talked about it kind of being painted up, I'm like, you know, I might have trim and stuff. No, you were not kidding.
No, it's painted up.
There are cherubs on the ceiling of this freaking car.
Yeah, it was designed, Clark of Wolverton. It was built for a era of the Woolworth estate, and they had a lot of money. That car new when it was sold was probably about $25,000. Can you imagine what that is in today's money in 1925?
It's a chunk of change and well-deserved. I mean, the burled wood, are those brass accoutrements?
There's some in there that are. But mostly it's carved wood and it's all gilded, but the seat is silk Abusan upholstery, hand done silk Abusan upholstery.
It's a beautiful couch. I wish I'd had that when I was dating when I was 16, but
we're not going to get into
what
that.
What an amazing vehicle. That's insane. I love it.
We knew the kind of crap you drove.
Yeah. It was two rolling couches, back seat, front seat, who cares? It was all good.
Ed, what's the dumbest thing you've ever done in a car?
Oh, man. There's probably been a number of dumb things.
Well, pick one that's outside the statute of limitations.
Yeah.
I mean, I've driven probably, 130 different Duesenberg chassis over the years. Rob Williams and I keep track we've kind of lost count, but we're up over half. You know, we've driven half of them. And I remember driving the Wayman Taper Tail with no brakes, with just the handbrake, you know, down the hill to the, you know, I mean, I've driven cars where the guy's got the knockoffs on the wheels on backwards and then spit a tire off of an Alpha at speed. I don't know. I've had, you know, I've unloaded and loaded so many trucks over the years. I mean, you know, so something can always happen there. But probably one of the scariest things I ever did was I was at Barrett Jackson, and we had the relationship with Chrysler at the time. And they brought down a bunch of cars from their museum, and one was a Chrysler Turbine car. And of course, you know, those things are really wild and they're cool. And they had built a podium that was like 4 feet off the ground, and they wanted to put it up on the podium. Well, we only had like 16 foot fiberglass ramps. Well, you can imagine the apex, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I said to the Chrysler guys, I said, well, I don't know. I mean, this doesn't look totally kosher to me. And they're like, well, yeah, but we want it up there. We want it up there. I said, all right, well, I'll watch it. They're like, no, we're not driving it. And everybody was,
of course you're not.
I said, oh, yeah, you want it up there, but you're not driving it. And I said, well, they go, you drive it. So I got a lesson or tutorial in turbine car, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I got on the ramps, and I'm like, God, you know, this thing, if I spit the, you know, if I go too slow, if I spit the ramp out and it drops, or if it, if I go too far on the podium, you know, because it's up in the air. I mean, oh man. Anyway, I got it up there. But that was probably the dumbest thing. I mean, that, that was dangerous, you know?
Yeah. Now, if you had fiberglass ramps and you're going up there with a turbine blasting out heat out of the back end, was there any worry about those things bowing before you got to the top?
No, never. No.
Fiberglass is fireproof. Got it.
Uh-huh.
Got it.
Well, let me explain that to you. Ed, you live in a rather unbelievable world. It's really cool hearing about it. We appreciate you coming on. We've been speaking with Ed Fallon of Cave Creek Classics and just about every place else under the sun. Please take a minute and tell us where we can find you online and on social media, Ed.
I don't do too much of that. Like I said, I'm kind of quiet. You know, everybody that needs to know me finds me. I guess if you need, if they need to find me, they can call you and you can get to me. otherwise through our Curiel, obviously. And, you know, I mean, I'm around, but yeah, you guys know how to find me.
Yes, we do, sir. Thank you very much. Ed, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I had a lot of fun.
Ed's been everywhere.
Oh,
done
man.
Everything. He's touched all the cool stuff.
Yeah, I know. He's driven every car that I would love to.
Yeah, no kidding.
Damn. Man. And a whole bunch that I didn't even know existed.
Okay, for the record, we took a break after we finished talking to Ed. Mark and I both looked up a bunch of the stuff he was talking about, that Saturnissima. You look at that. That, okay, the body was done by Ghia. Mm-hmm. So was the Di Tommaso Mangusta, and God, those things look a lot alike. Yeah.
Somebody
That's
borrowed
the
some
same
styling
car.
Tips.
Yes, a little bit. Yes. That's the same car inside and out. When you look at the interior on both of those cars, the only difference between the Saturnissima and the Mangusta is they swapped where the radio was and the switches were on the dash. I mean, everything else is the same, including the steering wheel. It is dead on. That's the same car.
And it's so funny. He's driven all of these things. Blah, blah, blah. And then he goes rolling around in the desert in a half track with a 50 cal on top.
Yeah,
you know, I'm like, you're living the life.
He talks about this so nonchalantly. He's gotten to do so much cool stuff, and he continues to. He said he's headed to Monaco.
Yeah.
That is so neat. So, Ed, thank you so much for being on with us,
that
man.
Was cool.
What cool stuff he's done. We have to have him back, like,
please,
tomorrow. It was a lot of fun. Thanks so much for spending time with Driven Radio. We love what we do, and we wouldn't be able to do it without the support of our listeners. If you can't tell, we love this.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we really dig it, and we get to talk to some of the coolest people and about all the neat stuff they do. You can find us online at DrivenRadioShow.com. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Driven Radio Show, and on LinkedIn as Driven Radio Show Podcast. Something we found out this year that is, God, I wish I would have known this a long time ago, and we would have been saying something about it a long time ago, but it took us a while to find this. We've discovered that the download numbers we get from our provider only represent a small fraction of the actual listens the show gets, and that streaming listens aren't included in that count. And on top of that, iTunes doesn't report squat download, streaming, or otherwise. None of that is included. So if you're listening to Driven Radio, please do us a favor and download the show so we can see just how much of an audience we have out there. Mark and I have long suspected that our numbers were quite a bit greater than what we've been seeing.
Suspected slash hoped.
There's always that hope. There's always that hope. And since we've been doing this, we've seen an uptick in our download numbers.
Thank
and we
you.
Are very appreciative for that.
Absolutely.
Thank you so very much. So if you're listening to the show, please take a minute, download it. Let us know that you're out there. And if you have a story you'd like to tell or someone you would like us to interview, please contact me at Brett@DrivenRadioShow. One of the people who has done that is a listener named Christopher who lives in Norway.
And oh, we're going no to way. Be Norway?
Norway.
No way.
Christopher, we're going to be speaking to him soon, as soon as we work out scheduling. Norway's 7 hours ahead of us.
Yeah.
We usually record at 7 in the evening when we both get done with work. We're going to have to work some things out, maybe record on a Saturday morning so Christopher can be awake and not, you know, keeping vampire hours.
Absolutely. It'll give me a chance to finally vent, get it off my chest about how many Chryslers they bought.
Well, he's he's also a fan of the Mordor cars, so you two
Hell
have
yeah.
quite a bit in common. And Christopher, if you're listening, and we know that you are, we're going to have you on soon enough. We're just going to figure out scheduling beforehand. We're going to make it easier on you. We really want to have you on the show, and thank you. And he's not the only Norwegian listener we have.
That's awesome.
Which is so why we get, you know,
I love Norwegia.
What?
Oh, hey, I'm jealous, but I love them.
Speaking of Norway, there's a chance there's another Norwegian listener out there, Ola Ness. Ola lived with my family my Aww. Senior year in high school. I haven't seen him in, you know, 36 years. But Ola does listen occasionally, and I think that's really cool. I don't think there's any way that the two of them know each other, but wouldn't that be neat?
Hey, he lives in Norway too. You know Ola, right?
Yeah, right. Because Norway's just the size of my neighborhood. How could they
know? Do you know how many Olas there are in the phone book?
Yeah, you kidding? I don't even know all my neighbors. Anyway, thank you for listening. I am Brett Hatfield for Mark L. Groves.
Yep.
And we'll see you next time here on Driven Radio.